Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
The following episode of Killer Jeans contains graphic and sensitive information and material. Listener discretion is advised. Welcome to Killer Jeans Stripped Down, where we talk about everything true crime and then some.
You'll hear about the cases that are close to us and go behind the scenes of true crime reporting.
We'll also talk about case updates and breaking news, as well as speak with some of our friends and colleagues in the world of true crime.
Now, we're going to be sharing things we've never been able to talk about because certainly inappropriate to post online, but this is the platform that we can finally share it, what really happens when gathering true crime stories.
So, let's get to it. We are joined now by Eros Artemis, who is the founder and president of Adaptive Operations. And Melissa, I understand you and Eros have worked together before in the past.
Yeah, so we did a really intense story together. It was one that I was working on Crime Watch Daily. Chris Hansen was the host, legendary crime legend. And we started this off in Naples, Florida, and ended up in Las Vegas, Nevada, where I met Eros. Thank you for joining us.
You bet. Glad to be with you, too.
I have so many questions for you because traveling for Crime Watch Daily for 3 years, it was the first time, you know, I've been crime reporting for a long time, but it was, and I've always been in danger, frankly, but it was the first time a network ever actually gave me protection. So it was something that I think other shows were fascinated by. I mean, I remember doing a job interview with Dateline, and they were fascinated at the fact that we had hired bodyguards. And the because this is a reveal episode where we kind of talk about the behind the scenes that we normally wouldn't be able to talk about, and we would certainly never, you know, post about it on social media. But it was always a thing with me where it was like a wink, wink to my bodyguard. Are you armed or are you not armed? Because a lot of people don't realize it costs more money to hire a bodyguard who's packing versus not. But regardless, when it comes down to showing up on an ambush of an accused killer, which is what we did on the show, ambushing and confronting them, it was always up to the actual hired security. And I don't remember, were you packing that day or not?
Yeah, any time I'm in a state where I'm legally able to, then I will never be found unarmed.
Yeah, that's the sentiment from a lot of security I talk to. That's where their comfort zone is, and it's certainly where my comfort zone is. But let me break down this case that we worked on together for everybody listening. It's a cold case, about 23 years old right now. It's the story of Wendy Hudacock from Florida. And she, one night in 1998, she was 14 years old. She told her sister, hey, I'm going to sneak out and go to a party. Her parents were out of town on an event just for a few hours. And she said, hey, don't tell, but I'm going to go to this party. She never came home that night. And turns out when detectives interviewed everybody at the party, they said, oh, yeah, Wendy showed up with this really creepy guy. Well, it turns out that man, Ron DiPeppo, who was 20 years old. Remember, Wendy's 14. Ron was 20. And everyone confirmed, were together at that party, felt awkward, ended up leaving, going back in his car, and she was never to be seen or heard from again. Now, police interviewed Ron, and at the time, he told detectives that, well, first of all, his car was just mysteriously burned to a crisp 1 week later, right? So that doesn't look good already. That's a huge red flag. And he said, oh, I was with my friend Johnny Walker. He's the witness. Johnny Walker is a registered sex offender, also older. And so they told detectives that, you know, first of all, Ron said Johnny was smoking a cigarette, threw it out, the wind blew it back in, ignited something in the back. Johnny said, no, that was Ron smoking. Johnny Walker did pass a polygraph at the time. He was cleared and on his way, kind of considered a witness. And then they took custody of the vehicle, found a hammer in the car. It was burned to a crisp, but no DNA whatsoever was retrieved, but that's weird. And it got so bad of the distress. Just imagine this teenager lost, right? And her family is distraught, doesn't know what to do. This guy is suspicious. He's older, last seen with his daughter. So her father actually goes one day to Ron DiPeppo's house and confronts him. And I remember the father telling me this story because it was bizarre and chilling. He said, and this was years ago, he looked at Ron and said he was with a friend of his who's a bigger dude, but Ron had a bunch of friends that day at his house. Shady looking characters is what the dad said. So he says to Ron, how did your car get set on fire? You told police you were smoking. And Ron looks at the father and says, I don't smoke, but he is smoking a cigarette while he is saying it. And then he drops it to the ground and he starts calling his missing daughter, Wendy, a bitch. And just belligerent, his friends circle this, you know, traumatized, concerned father. And that was his run-in with Ron DiPeppo. And detectives told me when I got on this case in 2018, 20 years later, that Ron DiPeppo was doing weird things over the years, such as writing letters and statements and tying them to rocks and throwing them into windows for police to find. And then when police would confront him about, you know, why are you doing this? What's this deal with the rocks? That, you know, obviously he had some kind of mental disorder, but none of us can diagnose what it is. But he was telling police that the writings were, Wendy is coming home soon. He is a disciple of God, and God speaks through him. So this is the person that we're dealing with when I link up with Eros in Las Vegas. And this is a man that went off the radar for a long time. Detectives in Florida couldn't even find him, but you did. How did that go down?
Yeah, so I was approached about the case, and I immediately felt like it was a case that fit into the purview of what I do. I focus on uniting families, and this one just felt different. And so I started looking into who Ron was and could see that I don't know what happened with the investigations. And he was barely even considered a person of interest in the investigation, it seemed. But nobody had really been able to pin him down for an interview, and I think that there was word he was up in Ohio for a time. I mean, this was like 20 years of people trying to pin him down, and then you guys had contacted me because you found out that there was rumor that he was in the Las Vegas area, and so I was first approached about being hired as a PI, and I've always felt like my skill set didn't go as well for just money. And so when I take a case, there's a lot more meaning behind it. And so I demanded that I do it as a volunteer, and I used my PI. I had a PI license in for Nevada, but I still volunteered on this case for the family and for you guys. But anyway, I started doing my own online sleuthing to figure out where Ron was. And thankfully he was very active on social media and had created these weird, chanting like almost or songs, rap songs, like he was some kind of, like he thought he was some kind of prophet or something, and he would, I don't know what he would, I believe that he was on some kind of drug when he would do it, or else just some heavy mental illness, and at the same time he was very good at protecting his location. In his videos, most of the time he stayed inside of his tent. And there was one video where he was rapping, and I tell you, it made my soul sick just listening to him and just the things he would say, and it was almost like a darkness, like this man was lost with no soul or something. And anyway, and there was one moment, like a split second, where he was videoing himself and he rotated, and it showed his tent door was open, and it showed just for a split second outside, and then he turned back again, and I paused the video at that spot, and then did a screenshot and zoomed it in and came up with this image that looked almost like you could see the tunnel drainages in Las Vegas, and the sounds of the videos, you could hear cars going by, and so I thought maybe it was close by the freeway by the amount of cars going by, and so I canvassed that particular area along I-15 in Las Vegas where it has some tunnel drainages that look like it, and there was a blue building, or building that was bluish, and it looked like maybe it was one of the taller buildings in Las Vegas farther away, and so I was trying to identify this location down there, and just really didn't have any success with that until later. But before I tell you what ended up happening with that photo, he posted a new video while I had been searching for that one clue, and it was really interesting because he had the presence of mind to be able to protect himself on the street. And in this video, he was being chased by a gang. There was a gang that was chasing after him, and he was on foot, and he runs across the street, and he turns his phone on live, and he's telling them, the whole world is watching you. Whatever you're planning to do to me, people are watching you.
Oh, he's on Facebook Live, right?
Yeah. And that's an important concept that I actually teach in self-defense and being able to protect yourself, you know, because it definitely worked for him. And these guys, he's got them all on Facebook Live showing their faces, and they just kind of stood down and walked away from him after chasing him. And so I did the same thing with that video, started analyzing it, and saw this type of park in the background. And then when I screenshotted it and zoomed it in, then I could see that it was actually a cemetery. And so I went through and figured out exactly the pattern of the fencing, what the fencing looked like, and then went through and searched all the cemeteries in Las Vegas, and I found that particular cemetery, and based on the positioning of from his camera, I was able to go to the exact location where he was with that, and then just doing surveillance out there, I watched the patterns of the homeless people, and saw that they were flowing to a soup kitchen at the Catholic Charities of Nevada, and then I figured out when they feed the homeless and stuff like that, and ended up finding Ron, and then I called you. My instructions were to call you. And they shifted my job. My job was originally to locate Ron DePepel. And I did. And I reported to my point of contact. And he said, call Melissa McCarty right now and let her know you've got eyes on him.
So I was in Los Angeles where I live, and I was given a heads up that you're getting close by Crime Watch Daily, and they said, be ready to get on a plane to Las Vegas at any moment. So my bag was packed, and I was just waiting. But Kelly, how insane, how genius is that? I mean, detectives couldn't find him.
I think it's amazing, Eros, what you did, and it just goes to show, you know, the use of social media and the power of social media. And while he was really trying to be careful to fly under the radar, he slipped up. Eros, what was your impression of Ron when you were watching him?
Well, he was, he had a presence of mind that he moved around normal. He didn't break the baseline of somebody that was out of their mind, like in his videos. So I was kind of surprised to see him in person and to be videoing him and taking photos of him as he's moving around the streets there. And, you know, he would go to go to lunch at the Catholic Charities of Nevada. And then he would walk up to the library. And I suspect it's because he would tie into their Wi-Fi or something. And he had his girlfriend that followed him around. She was pushing the cart. He was on his bike, and he communicated like a normal person, and like a person that he communicated differently than the person he was when he was doing his videos. And I knew I needed to be able to break off, because Melissa wouldn't be coming back until the next day. And so I had to establish as much pattern as I can. So diving into this guy, who this guy is and where he's at. And then that's where we went to coming back to that other video, the other screenshot outside of his tent. I needed to know where his tent was so I could find him again the next day when Melissa got there. And I have friends in the intelligence community, and I sent them the photo, and they, within 20 minutes, they sent me in an address, and it was just a couple of blocks from that location. And I went and took some photos of that to compare it, and it was exact. And then but that allowed me to find where his tent was so that we could find him again the next day when Melissa got there. But the in answering your question, it was definitely, I was surprised of his normal, how he seemed to appear to not have mental health issues as he is walking around and talking to people and moving. And that surprised me until we actually got to the interview when I was with Melissa and we caught up with him.
Did you see any signs that he might be armed and dangerous?
Well, I was pleased to find him where he moved around without a shirt on, and being able to see that he had no weapons on his waistline. I was terribly concerned about bringing Melissa into that particular area, because when it comes to being an executive protection agent or bodyguard, I was trained by a U.S. Secret Service agent that worked for three different presidents, and one of the number one rules is you don't take your principal into, or your protectee into hostile situations or potentially hostile situations. You go away from it. And the job they asked me to do to now get Melissa and take her to him was a complete no-no in the, it's taboo in the executive protection world. And
yeah, that's crime reporting. Yeah, I mean, you know, yeah. Not a lot of people in the country actually do it. There aren't a lot of shows that do this. There aren't a lot of journalists that do this. But you know, we did. And anyway, this leads up to the moment, because I will never forget. First of all, we waited for him to have his meal in the morning, and then we wanted him to walk away from that environment because it was too crowded. So we were on a stakeout. We were watching him the entire time in a car across the street. It was myself, a photographer, and you. And we waited for him to walk down the street away from the crowd. And we just hopped out of the vehicle. We were about a block away, and we just started walking over. And I remember I was a bit anxious walking over. I have no idea. I just saw these videos and couldn't understand his mindset or his mind frame, or what if my line of questioning would trigger him in any way. It would trigger anybody, you know. And it's 20 years later, out of the blue, you have a camera in your face, a reporter, and, you know, yourself. So I just remember I walked up to him and I introduced myself, and he immediately said, "Why are you following me? You've been following me for days." And I said, "I just arrived to town. I haven't been following you. I just got here this morning. And I want to talk to you about Wendy Hudacock. You were the last person to see her alive."
Didn't he say, "You've been following me since I got off the Greyhound bus"?
He did.
And what was he, Eros, did you ever see him get off of a Greyhound bus?
No, and that's the interesting side of it. I mean, this guy, he did have some severe paranoia.
Severe.
I mean, you now know where I had followed him, and it had nothing to do with, you know, Greyhound bus. It was the day that Melissa and I caught up with him, and the day before were the only times I actually had eyes on him. And so, you know, I think it was just a paranoia for some reason.
Yeah. He said, "You're following me and it's illegal." And I explained to him that I wasn't. And then I moved quickly past and I just said, "Listen, you know, you were the last person to be with Wendy. You were the last person known to see her alive." He immediately starts to speak and walk over to his backpack. And then I just see you fling into the picture and you try to beat him to his backpack to see if he's going to pull out a gun or not. What were you thinking in that moment?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So I was on edge and I was pointing out to you too before that the homeless people in that area, they have knives hidden next to umbrellas and canes and stuff in their hand, and they have guns, and they have weapons. And so when he starts moving to his bag, I know I can't grab him or grab his bag or anything like that, but I got into a position where I could get eyes on his bag. If he's opening it and going to be reaching in, I want to see exactly what he's grabbing. And that's what I did. I just hurried and got into a position where I could see exactly what his hands were doing, because hands kill. Somebody doesn't have a ability to use their hands, they're not going to be able to hurt you very well. But their hands have that ability. And so I just made sure I saw exactly what his hands were grabbing. And he grabbed some, I think he grabbed the Bible, if
Indeed.
I remember right.
Yeah. And I was, by the way, very impressed, and I felt so safe. And it's important to mention that, you know, Ron at the time wasn't a suspect, but he was a person of interest. And his friend Johnny Walker, currently still a person of interest in this cold case. But I'm just going to read so people understand what we were dealing with. And, you know, everyone can say how they would react and what they would do in the situation. And should I have pressed harder? Should I have done this? You know, but this is verbatim the conversation that took place. So, you looked in his bag, and he, at the same time, he's looking at you like, "Dude, what are you doing?" He pulls out a Bible and he's saying, and I quote, this is verbatim. He says, "I know the enemy is trying to hurt me, and all I ask the Lord right now is that I'm innocent." And I said, "Ron, I'm not saying you are guilty." And he said, "Who is guilty are these oppressors around me." And then I asked, I said, "Well, how did your car ignite on fire 1 week later after you were with Wendy?" And he says, "That was all a setup, orchestrating it." This is his words verbatim. "That was all a setup, orchestrating it forwardly, self-willed, not of God." And then he told me Johnny Walker wasn't there. But he told police years prior they were together in the car, and that's how it ignited on fire from a cigarette. And then my last question to Ron is, I said, you know, do you ever think about it? Do you ever think about her or what happened? And, I said, can you just talk me through all of it? And he said, I think about when King David said the whole world will know that there is a God. I think about that. I would rise and she would come to her truth, but he hasn't raised yet. And he's working on the reality of that. And that's when I just ended the line of questioning because, you know, regardless of whether he was involved in her disappearance or murder or not, he's someone who's not fit for a trial, first of all, and certainly not fit for a continued questioning on this incident, you know, because either it was an act, which the family of Wendy Hudecock believes it was an act. They believe he's suppressing guilt so much this is what's coming out. Who knows the mental state and the truth of what's happening in his mind? But when he was saying those things, did you think he was putting on an act? Was it genuine? What was your take on that?
Well, as a trained private investigator, I stick with the facts. And so, you know, the facts are facts there. And what I can say is that he clearly showed immediate signs of deception. Going from seeing an established pattern of how he was communicating with people to all of a sudden, and even when he started communicating with us at first, it was logical. It was, well, there's laws that are protecting me and you can't do this and you can't do that, to when the pressure came on with you started tightening the screws down with the questioning that was clearly sensitive to him. Then he started going into his religious ramblings and acting like a prophet, and started moving to that person that he is in his videos. And, you know, I mean, opinions are opinions, right? And if I were to give an opinion, it would just be looking at what the indicators could be pointing at. And I'm inclined to feel a little more like what the family was thinking, when he was making up scripture, when he was making up his comments, you could see that his train of thought started flowing away, and then he had to kind of end off what he was saying because his mind ended in its creativity and he wasn't able to answer your question because it came across as he just did not want to answer that. And he was trying to protect himself from saying something and that it would incriminate him even more. But yeah, it was, so the best thing I could probably say is the indicators in my mind, the indicators of deception lead to more of what the family was saying, but I'm no specialist in that area. I use, in my trainings and my work, I use those indicators of deception as a new direction for asking questions and trying to dig up new facts. And so more like what the parents are thinking is where I would stand.
So we know that Walker moved from a witness to a person of interest. We know that Ron DePepo has never been charged or arrested with anything regarding this case. He's still considered a person of interest, though, and it's our understanding that there is a new detective on it, which is great. So hopefully they'll get somewhere with that. But what was it about Wendy and this case, Eros, that really stuck with you and is, you know, continued your fight for it?
The family. I work with a lot of missing. I've done quite a bit of missing person cases, and it's hard for private investigators to take missing person cases because you can't predict how long it's going to take and how much to charge families and so I do that for free for families, and because I know. And when I walk into a household where there's a missing loved one, I can feel the burden come off of them, because moms and dads that are working, they can't think straight. When they're trying to do their job and they have a loved one that's missing, it's hard to engage your brain and to separate the emotion and be able to focus on work. And then when they're at home, everything they look at reminds them of their missing loved one. And so I do it for the families. In some respects, I claim that I rescue families, you know, so they can get back to work and they get somebody that's professional out there looking for their missing loved one. And so it's the family on why I do it.
Yeah. This, so what had affected me on this story, I'm just, his family brought me to tears as well, but also the detective. So, you know, detectives have a certain demeanor and armor that they carry, and they have to. I'm sure you do as well. But talking to the detective who was retired by 2018 when I interviewed him for the very first time on this story, he actually choked up when I said, what is your biggest regret or frustration on this case? And that is, you know, within the hour and a half interview, the moment that he was brought to tears, because he said, we weren't able to bring her home. And I felt his pain on working on a case for 2 decades that is still unsolved, and the ache in his heart for the family. And yes, the family is so beautiful and such incredible people, the way, and they still want this solved. They want answers, you know, and they want what they consider justice, and it is heartbreaking. And what you do, it's people like you that just make their lives a little bit better and easier during such a horrific tragedy, especially the fact that you're not charging. I mean, that is it's incredible that you can even do that, because I know how time consuming it is and how much energy you even put into helping us. Do you, how often now are you doing missing persons, or are you more so shifting your focus on human trafficking?
Well, so I decided to take my private investigation work and executive protection work, all of that stuff, and wrap it into a nonprofit organization, because I like to just do stuff that has more meaning behind it than money. And then that way people could donate to my organization and help me. And so it's Adaptive Ops, or Adaptive Operations is the official name. But, I work full time in searching for missing people, and I don't just take any missing person case. I focus on the families that their loved one is at risk or is being trafficked. And I do essentially the same thing with what I did with you. I will locate their loved one, figure out the patterns. And if they're young adults, I will create those patterns, figure out those patterns so that I could take a loved one there and protect them while they are the ones talking their loved one out of that situation. And I'm running interference. I'm the one talking to the trafficker, so that the family can have their time with their loved one. That's a pretty common part of what I do. And then I work with survivor leaders, women who were trafficked at one point in their life, and they become the leaders in this industry and helping get girls out and boys as well. And they call upon me, and then I go and provide protection for them while they're doing high risk escapes for girls and boys. And so that's what I do full time now.
And you are the founder, president of Adaptive Operations, a nonprofit. Eros, what regions do you go to do this? Are you nationwide, worldwide, or where do you see is the most problematic area where you get the most cases?
Well, I'm pretty selective on my cases. Since you guys have a a good listener base, if there was anything I'd want them to know is that anywhere there's drug trafficking, there's human trafficking. And so I pick and choose my cases carefully. A couple months ago, I was in Baltimore. Last week, I was in a state on the West Coast. I can't say where it was because it's still an active case. And I've worked in over 20 major U.S. cities, and so there is no particular area. And I've done cases in three different countries as well, freeing child slaves and you know, helping unite families. And so I'm all over the country, really.
Eros, if somebody out there listening needs your help with a missing loved one, how can they get in touch with you?
It's adaptiveops.org. This is where it's really difficult because there's far too many people, far too many cases than what I can even handle. And so I've been cautious about sending out, you know, what I do, but I can at least connect people with others that can help. But otherwise it's adaptiveops.org. And we need resources. We need help in being able to stay out in the field. And, but I do provide trainings and I do guide families. If I can't become boots on the ground, then I will give input to the families of what to do for being able to find their loved one faster.
You know, Eros, what you do is so admirable. And, you know, I thank you graciously from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure for all of our listeners as well. What made you even get into this line of work? I mean, was there a particular case or something close to you or a family member? You know, what triggered this passion?
Well, it's not anything I really talk about much, but I had a rough childhood where I had a stepdad who was a drug dealer, and they exploited girls and boys alike, and they were trying to teach me to be like them. And by the time I was 14, I had taken my stand against them and wasn't interested in being one of them. And I was drawn to beauty and innocence in this world. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to have a nice family. I wanted to help others enjoy, you know, that kind of peace and innocence in life. And so that's what I was drawn to. That's where the direction I went. And I actually had a fight, a physical fight with my stepdad, and you know, and he realized when I wasn't quitting that I'm not one of them. And so I think in the root of it, it was my past that way, and that the ability to be able to do this work, I mean, just being who I am, I'm a person of faith, and I feel like it's a calling for me to do this.
So that happened to you when you were a teenager. Did you have to still endure that environment till you're of a certain age? Did you take off, you know, did you leave home at a young age because of it?
No, my mother was a pretty amazing woman, but she had to work 12-hour days or more with a commute. And so, you know, I found myself pretty much free to do what I needed to do. And she was an amazing mother. She just did the very best she could. And so I was pretty free to roam. And any teenager or any child that is roaming the streets is going to find bad things. And I didn't get exploited myself. They were putting me on a pedestal to become one of them. And so they treated me differently. And so, for me, it was, I mean, my teenage years were glorious and incredible, stuff that country songs are made of. You know, I worked hard and played in the small town and had, and found good friends and stuff like that. So, I think it was more of, I got the foundation of how the drug markets worked, and from manufacturing to packaging and distributing into dealers and all of that. I saw it all, and how they exploited their own daughters, their own children to each other. You know, it was, is a dark scene, and that's never stopped. That kind of thing goes on in every town, every small town. It doesn't matter where you are.
Yeah, I mean, and, you seeing that predatorial behavior, it's, I love that you grew up wanting to combat it and fight it and shed light. You know, growing up, it wasn't predatorial behaviors that I saw, but I grew up in really rough neighborhoods where it was just riddled with gang members and crime. And two of my friends were murdered, you know, very young. So I saw criminal behavior in people that I thought were, it was just my environment, and it sickened me. And it also made me feel very helpless. So I also find it very interesting that I ended up coming, you know, becoming a crime reporter, shedding light on these things. Because when I was at that age, very young, I was quiet. You know, I didn't say, I was afraid of these people. So I relate to your story. And I think it's very powerful that you took that trauma and that disdain and flipped it into something very special to help others.
I think one thing that also makes the difference at who I am, like I indicated that I confront the traffickers so the family can talk their loved ones out. The one thing that I really learned about is even the traffickers, and I mentioned I'm a person of faith. I really believe that human trafficking is broken sons and daughters of God breaking other sons and daughters of God. And so when I confront the traffickers, I know that sometimes the victims really love the person that's exploiting them. And I have a friend that's a repentant trafficker, and he's guided me and helped me understand a lot of things to help counter human trafficking. And even my own stepfather, I loved him, and I didn't like the things he was involved in. And I'm not sure he truly had a better opportunity in life than that kind of a path. But he had saved my little brother and sister from a burning house when back in 1988. And even though he had this illicit background, he also became Father of the Year because of that. And so it's not cut and dry out there. It's not bad guys, good guys. You know, there's some, and so people who try to come into this industry to work with me, they, that's the hardest part for them to understand, is that, you know, just because we're dealing with a guy who's being bad at that moment doesn't mean he can't eventually become good again. And so we're not going out there to kill people. You know, this is about simply uniting families and helping bring justice to the victims. And a lot of times the victims, they don't want the justice, you know, they don't want cold, hard justice brought upon that person. They just want things to go back to normal. They just want peace and happiness. And we try to help align that and align the survivors with proper services and housing. And more importantly, we focus a lot on education to prevent that kind of stuff from happening. And then we go into the belly of the beast and help get them out if they get trapped in them.
I want to go back to Wendy's case for 1 second, Eros, if that's okay, because you brought up a big point, you know, of wanting justice. With Wendy, I don't think, I always say there is no such thing as justice. There's only answers. Because justice would have been that crime, that missing person, that murder, it never would have happened in the first place. So all we can do is provide answers, because it's not going to bring her back. Do you think in a case like Wendy's that there will be answers one day?
I definitely believe that. I taught criminal justice for a couple of years and teaching crime scene investigations to these new students who are studying to become police officers, preparing for the academy. I am always surprised at the advancements in forensics and all types of forensics. And I believe there will eventually be a way that technology will advance to the point where Wendy will absolutely, the clues will lead to cold hard facts that will reveal exactly what's going on. Aside from that, even in the Crime Watch Daily case that's published on YouTube with it, the comments, there are people in there, and I've contacted the investigators and said, hey, you need to follow up on this. This is pretty serious stuff. There's people that have said, oh, I was doing drugs with that guy, and he told me that he had killed someone. You know, that's an actual comment in there. You know, and I immediately said, hey, you need to contact detective so and so, and you know, and then I passed it on to the detective. Whether it was real or not.
Was that Anna Horowitz, the current detective?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. I passed it on to Ann Horowitz, yeah.
Well, it was interesting to me that Johnny Walker went from a witness to a person of interest. I got the impression they're leaning at him more than Ron, but I mean, I don't know that's shocking to me. But I truly believe those two men, their stories have changed so many times. They know something. That's as far as I'm going to go with it. They know something. But also, I believe that they're close enough to solve this case. It's been 23 years. I think it's possible.
Eros, are you still keeping tabs on DiPeppo?
I do. I watch. I haven't seen him since then, but I follow his Facebook, and nothing has changed. He's still that same character with his messages, but otherwise, you know, I don't physically go and I would never want to be accused of harassing. You know, I had a specific purpose, a specific job to find him for the interview. Anything beyond that could potentially be harassment, and I'm not going to do that, you know.
Very true.
If there was another purpose for contacting him, then I absolutely would.
Well, I felt so safe with you by my side, and I, you know, would work a case with you any day, and I just appreciate everything you do, Eros. And honestly, I want every producer listening right now, Eros Artemis of Adaptive Ops, you have a biopic in the making. Your life story is fascinating. I could have asked you a million more questions, but I know we're running on an hour, but your life story.
Well, I know that I feel safer, Eros, knowing that you and guys like you are out there. So thank you very much for all that you do.
Thank you for your bravery. Melissa, you're truly a brave soul in what you've done. And so it's been my honor and privilege to work with you and to be a part of this cool Killer Jeans podcast. I love it. I've been listening to it. It is super cool, you guys.
Awesome. Straight from, you know, boots on the ground. We love that. Right. Well, keep in touch. And if there's ever a case important to you, reach out. You know, we've got your back. So thank you for chatting with us.
Yeah, my privilege. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Follow Killer Jeans on Facebook and on Instagram. It's at Killer Jeans, the podcast.
Also, be sure to like and subscribe to Killer Jeans on Podcast One, Apple, or wherever you listen to podcasts.